Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Investigator Perspectives on available research and challenging questions in renal cell cancer. And specifically, we're here today to do a post-ASCO review of what happened at ASCO related to renal cell carcinoma. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Raina McKay from the University of California, San Diego, and the Moores Cancer Center in La Jolla, California, and Professor Thomas Pals from the Barts Cancer Institute in London, United Kingdom. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we do in all of our webinars, there's a one pre-meeting and post-meeting survey in the chat room. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of this experience today. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars, particularly the replays. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program on RCC with Dr. Chouari. We do webinars all the time. Tomorrow, we've got a really exciting one on triple-negative breast cancer. I've got a bunch of cases of from general medical oncologists and community-based practice that we're going to present to our faculty. Next year, we'll continue our year in review series and talking about gynecologic oncology, particularly some of the wild checkpoint inhibitor stuff that's going on with endometrial cancer. July the 9th, we'll be doing a year in review program on myeloma, see what's going on in terms of CAR-T, but particularly bispecifics. And then on the 17th, we've got a great program on ADCs. We have Professor Schmidt, Tom's, Powell's colleague there at Barts Institute, and Dr. Tulaney from Dana-Farber. This should be a really exciting program. I've already worked with both of them this week. We're doing a program on ALK therapy, ALK-targeted therapy, and non-small cell. But today we're here to talk about renal cell cancer, not just to talk about what happened at ASCO, but just to provide a quick update on some of the common clinical dilemmas that come up in practice regarding RCC. As always, we will be talking about the use of unapproved agents and unapproved regimens, so check out the package insert for more information. Here's where we're heading today. We asked both of our faculty to prepare a short presentation focused on new papers, particularly from ASCO. Tom is going to get into metastatic clear cell carcinoma and some other things, and Raina will get into non-metastatic, you know, localized adjuvant therapy particularly, and non-clear cell. And then we'll talk about we'll cover a lot of ASCO in those two talks. And then we have a few others that we'll pick up if we have time at the end, orals from ASCO and RCC, see what the faculty thinks about that. But we also wanted to incorporate sort of a clinical update as part of this program. So we put together four sort of segments in the program as we go, in addition to these talks, just to give the faculty a chance to update a little bit on where we are today, and particularly compared to maybe where we were a year ago. What did we learn at ASCO related to these questions? But really importantly, just to capsulize where you are currently. And the first question, Raina, which has been out there the last few years, are we going back and forth on first-line therapy, metastatic, clear cell? Of course, one big question being combination immunotherapy, ipi/nivo versus TKI-IO, and then which TKI-IO would you like us to provide a 2024 update of where you are clinically outside a clinical trial setting, Raina, in that decision?
Oh, absolutely. So I think, the field has moved into IO combination therapies in the frontline space for those patients that do warrant treatment. We know that there are some patients that have kidney cancer that are favorable risk with low volume disease who could conceivably be watched or undergo metastasis-directed therapy. But for those individuals that necessitate treatment, I think the field has largely moved into IO combination therapies for those individuals. And there's two main classes of drugs or combinations. There's the IO-IO combination of nivolumab plus ipilimumab, and then three life-prolonging IO-VEGF combinations, including pembrolizumab plus axitinib, nivolumab plus cabozantinib, and pembrolizumab plus lenvatinib. And there's probably more similarities among the IO-VEGF agents combinations than there are differences. In my clinical practice, when I have a patient before me that has metastatic disease, there are some questions that I go through and ask. I try to understand what is their IMDC risk score. Are they favorable, intermediate, or poor? I try to tease out their histology. Are they clear cell or non-clear cell? And one of the most predominant things that's important to understand is their sarcomatoid status, because that can inform decision making. And generally, I tend to get a sense of also their pace of disease and burden of disease. And are they rapidly progressing, or are they, slow progressing, or don't have a high tumor burden? For those patients that have rapid disease progression or have high tumor burden, I tend to favor IO-VEGF. For those patients that are not in that category, I tend to favor IO-IO. And when I'm in the clinic, I ask myself, do I have to play the short game? Meaning, do I need a regimen with a low PD rate, a high response rate, great PFS, or do I have the luxury of playing the long game? Meaning, do I lean for a regimen that is associated with long-term durability? So that's my general approach for individuals with metastatic disease. I think for those patients that are sarcomatoid, they tend to get IO-IO independent of whatever category they're in.
So Tom, first of all, maybe you can comment on what of Arena's description you might not be following exactly, but also can you pick up on another important issue, which is which, if you're going to go with IO, TKI, which one? You have a great slide I've seen you show a few times of three identical twins, et cetera. But I'm curious, A, do you subscribe to Reina's approach to whether or not you're going to use a TKI-IO or not? And then how do you choose the IO-TKI combination?
Yeah, so I agree with Reina. I think that it's fair to say that there are four combinations. They're all PD-1 based. And when you look at the survival curves, there are more similarities than differences in the intermediate and poorest population. And so pick one and use it well. I think there is a commercial battle that's ongoing, which is understandable. There are four competitive regimes. And I think you will hear people say, well, this one's better at that and this one's better at that. The reality is there are many more similarities than there are differences, particularly between the VEGF TKI IOs. And it's much more important to learn about management of toxicity, to have good support networks, to have well-informed patients. These are all 10 times more important than Cabo-Nivo versus Len-Pen. And as soon as you get into that debate where you start comparing them, inevitably, some of the other more important pieces, if you get a grade 3 transaminitis, can you re-challenge? Do you need to give steroids with grade 2 diarrhea? These sorts of issues then blur into the background. So I'm keen to put these toxicity issues in the forefront and discuss less about subtle differences between these regimes.
So another factor I wonder, you know, how you think through, Reina, is a patient where maybe you're not, you don't feel that strongly one way or the other about which broad strategy, whether it's going to be, say, Ipi-Nivo versus IO-TKI. But then there's some other issue that makes you concerned about autoimmune toxicity. For example, last night we did a webinar on lung, and we were talking about this grading that they've developed for predicting whether or not they're going to get colitis. Or if you have people where they have prior autoimmune problems, are you more likely to think about TKI-IO, or both of them are equally concerning?
Yeah, no, very good question, because I think this comes up in clinical practice. And what I ask myself is, well, what kind of autoimmunity does that individual actually have? Is the autoimmunity like, you know, a thyroiditis? Is the autoimmunity just rheumatoid arthritis? Or is it something like myasthenia gravis? Or did they ever have, do they have underlying Crohn's disease? So I think actually trying to tease out the type of autoimmune illness that individual has, and the severity at which they had it, and whether they received any immune modulating agents, will be important. In general, for people that have had a history of significant toxicity, I tend to not give those individuals IO therapy, and that's a situation where I may consider using VEGF monotherapy in the frontline setting. There's really good data for cabozantinib. But for those individuals that may have a dermatologic, rheumatologic condition, or, you know, maybe they had, you know, type 1 diabetes, but they're on their insulin and they're doing okay, you could conceivably give them a doublet with caution and engagement with your consulting, colleagues.
So, Tom, I think that's a good introduction to your talk. I'm really looking forward to seeing the data. But before you get started, I've got like an interesting anecdote about both of you that I wanted to share with the audience. And Tom, I'm going to share with you Raina's anecdote first, okay? Because I don't know if you know. So Raina was nice enough to agree to fly all the way across the United States and participate in a meeting we were doing, I think, about 6 weeks ago. It was a whole weekend long meeting. I think she was speaking at the end of the day Saturday. And Saturday morning, I start getting these messages that her plane is delayed. And all day long, I'm like getting messages. Okay, she's on the flight. Okay, she landed in Miami. And literally, we changed the order of the day. We moved people. Everybody was so nice to do it. And literally 3 minutes before she was due to come on, I get this message. She's in the lobby. And she walked in. Nobody in the audience had any idea. It was like, you know, you were so dedicated, Raina, to get there. I can't even thank you enough, but it was just
an amazing. I was supposed to fly out the night before. They canceled my flight the night before and put me on the morning flight. And I was like, oh no, you know, once that starts happening, but it was excellent to be there. It was a fantastic meeting, getting to engage with all the clinicians that are just on the front line seeing patients. So thank you for the opportunity.
No, it was great. You know, we had docs from the Florida Cancer Specialists on the stage with us asking questions. It was a great thing. But nobody had any idea the drama that preceded you walking in the room. And I never got a chance to thank you for being so dedicated to do that.
You know, I have another story for you. I grew up in South Florida. And at the end of my talk, my mom's oncologist from like 20 years ago came up to me and said, what? I can't believe this is you, and said hello.
Wow.
So everything happens for a reason. So
thank you. Things definitely happen for So I have just as good a story about Tom, but I'll wait until your talk to tell you about Tom's story. But meanwhile, Tom, let's talk about what we've been talking about for years, first line therapy, metastatic clear cell cancer, and sequencing.
Thank you. I'm slightly I have a degree of trepidation about my story. I can't imagine what it might be. We'll have to wait and see. Look, what I've said so far, I think, is true, that we have a series of PD-1 based regimes, and we don't talk very much anymore about avelumab. But actually, the first trial that was positive for PFS, not OS, was axitinib in combination with avelumab. And Bob Motzer presented the final OS data of this today. ASCO, excuse me. And you'll be aware that there have been previous presentations of these data sets, and you can see them here. The take-home message from the data to date, and the reason why PD-L1 inhibitors, avelumab and atezolizumab, are not widely recommended, although FDA approved for the case of axitinib and avelumab in this disease, is they never achieve that OS signal. And here you can see the previous two data cuts, and you can see OS hazard ratios of 0.78 and 0.79. You might remember the first OS hazard ratio for axi-pembro was 0.53, and that's why that was used in preference. And here you can see the final OS analysis. There were co-primary endpoints. The primary endpoint was in the PD-L1 positive population. That shows how long ago we designed this trial. We wouldn't do that now. And you can see the hazard ratios in the mid 0.8s. And so I think it's still fair to say that this doesn't have a major role to play. It still is a choice between axi-pembro, cabo-nivo, and len-pen presented and approved in that order. So this doesn't change very much from my perspective. We look at the favorable risk population. There's nothing striking there. you'll be aware in the audience that the big area of debate remains around favorable risk. And the reason why that's the case is it's currently the case that all approaches, single agent VEGF TKI therapy, VEGF TKI PD-1 therapy, and even, dare I say it, with the 8-year most recent update, Ipi-Nivo, all look to have an argument why you might want to use them in favorable risk disease. Intermediate and poor is straightforward. Pick one, use it well. Favorable, more complicated. And actually, you could probably argue for any of the approaches. I'm now going to move to KEYNOTE-426. Now, KEYNOTE-426 was that axitinib and pembrolizumab data. And we know that that had a significant survival advantage. We know it's widely used. Certainly I like using it, and I know many of my friends and colleagues do. We showed for the first time at ASCO this year some biomarker data, and we showed both DNA alterations, which essentially didn't show anything spectacular, but also some RNA sequence data. And the RNA sequence data looked at T effector signatures, that's T cell GEP, and angiogenic signatures. These were within arm analysis, so they weren't comparing the pembroaxi arm with the sunitinib arm, and I can explain why that was the case in a minute. But essentially, so these p-values are saying in the T-cell GEP signature, for example, if you had a high immune signature, you did better with axi-pembro than if you had a low immune signature for axi-pembro. So it was discriminatory within arms. And it shouldn't come as a big surprise that the immune signature that was high was good for pembroaxi, and the VEGF TKI signature that was high, the angiogenic signature was high, was discriminatory for sunitinib, and PD-L1 not really working at all. This is that mutational status data, and essentially PBRN1, VHL, STED2, and BAP1 have all been implicated in the past. And maybe something going on between PBRN1 with immune checkpoint inhibition with axi-pembro, but essentially mutations not proving to be very useful. We then go to the CLEAR trial, and almost identical analysis was performed in the CLEAR trial for LEN-PEN versus sunitinib, whole exome sequencing, PD-L1 analysis, and RNA sequencing. PD-L1 biomarker, again, didn't really work very well. This is a busy slide, and all this tells you is, unlike with axi-pembro, the GEP signature, the immune signature, didn't seem to pick the winners for lenvatinib and pembrolizumab. And what this begins to tell me, anyway, is that we've got a lot of noise, we've done lots of analyses, a lot of it's exploratory, and we're not showing any consistent signals for the VEGF signature or the GEP immune signature with immune checkpoint inhibition. So we've not successfully found a biomarker by RNA sequencing or by PD-L1 IHC or by DNA analysis. So we've come to a bit of a crossroads. I'm also showing this slide because you'll be aware that there's some work on molecular signatures, so you can categorize patients into groups by their RNA signatures. And you can see there are lots of different categories have been made, but you know, it's unfortunately the case that LEN-PEN seems better in all of those. So once again, we're lacking discriminatory signatures in that respect. So in my opinion, we've probably got to the point where we don't need to look any further from a tissue perspective. And I think the tissue RNA immunohistochemistry and DNA analysis has probably, in my opinion, gone as far as we can take it, which is why I wanted to show you some data on KIM-1. And KIM-1 is an exciting biomarker. It's a blood-based biomarker. Essentially, KIM-1 is associated with kidney injury, and it's released when kidney cells are damaged. It seems to go up in clear cell renal cancer, and high levels were associated with relapse after successful surgery. But more importantly, it also seems to predict response to immune checkpoint inhibition. So we've got a marker, a new marker in kidney cancer that might be both prognostic and predictive. Now, there's been previous work in this space, which also looks promising. So this is actually probably the best biomarker we have. It's also the case that in those patients who relapse, KIM-1 expression goes up. It's a protein measured in the blood. It's pretty easy to measure. It's already used by the nephrologists. So this is something perhaps that we can take forwards. The next chapter in the last few seconds I wanted to talk about was belzutifan, which is a HIF inhibitor. We know a little bit about HIF inhibition from Christmas time at ASCO and before at ESMO last year. Essentially, it's outperformed belzutifan from a progression-free but not an overall survival perspective, has outperformed everolimus from a PFS perspective. And you can see a bit of a tail on this curve. It's also, although there's no survival signal, we're expecting updated survival data in the not too distant future. But it's true that this combination, this monotherapy, this HIF inhibitor is actually really well tolerated. Some anemia and some hypoxia, but the quality of life data presented at ASCO GU this winter, suggested that this was an attractive combination, both from an efficacy perspective, PFS was better, toxicity perspective, but also a quality of life perspective. And this has become my standard third line therapy. So ipi-nivo, cabozantinib, followed by belzutifan. And of course, axi-pembro, cabozantinib, belzutifan as well. It's been used in combination with other agents. And I've got to tell you, some of the early combination data is really exciting. And we're looking forward to some randomized trials, both in the second line space, but also in the frontline space. This may be the most important frontline trial out there at the moment. Len-Pen versus the triplet with belzutifan. I think it might be positive for PFS. I certainly hope so. The last couple of slides I have is around subcut approach. So nivolumab is now being used potentially in a subcut rather than IV approach. And what I can tell you from a randomized trial, it's an underpowered non-inferiority efficacy trial, but an appropriately powered PK and quality of life trial. And what I can tell you is the subcut approach looks easy to give. The PK data looks the same. The PFS data looks very similar. And the quality of life data also looks good. I've got a feeling we may be moving to subcut approaches in the future. Here's the safety summary. You can see the grade 3 or 4 adverse events, very similar in both groups. I think, Neil, I'm going to stop there. Any questions for me?
Yeah, quite a few of them. First of all, I'm curious how you pronounce the word subcutaneous. I never heard of subcut.
Did I say subcut?
You said subcut. Oh, is that like a UK thing? I never heard of subcut. I kind of like it.
I think it's a UK thing, Neil. I think it's a UK thing. Subcutaneous. I apologize. It's subcutaneous nivolumab.
No, but I mean, Raina, have you ever heard somebody say subcut? I've heard of sub-Q.
But I'm learning something.
We call it sub-Q, guy. It's sub-Q. Over here, it's sub-Q. Okay, anyhow, let's get back to more realistic issues. Okay, so a lot of questions. Well, let's just go back a little bit to something that's confused me for a long time that you kind of referred to, which is the favorable, unfavorable thing. You know, us out here in the world, we're not like Talmudic scholars of RCC like you guys are, that you like to dissect everything. We just want to know, like, what to do. So, and, you know, when you try to apply these, you know, the classification system, somehow it doesn't seem that clinical. So let me just ask my vision of what I would call clinically favorable, Raina, is a patient, let's say, who had a nephrectomy, you know, 5 years ago, presents with metastatic disease, but it's non-visceral, and the patient is asymptomatic. So, clinically, now you have a patient like that, are you then going to like treat them like favorable? And how are you going to treat them? Are you going to even treat them?
Yeah.
Do you use any of the scales? Like, how do you figure out a case like that, Raina?
No, very good question. So the first question I ask is, what's their volume of disease and do they even need systemic therapy? Because there's some people that they're 5 years in and you find a pulmonary nodule and you may just be able to watch that individual. Or if you find low burden disease, you may, and it's oligometastatic, you may offer them a metastatectomy or SBRT. You know, they've got a couple of lung nodules, you may SBRT those. So I think with the favorable risk patients, these patients do well. And I think why the data is confusing is because many of these patients go on to see multiple lines of treatment and they generally do very well. And so it's really hard to assess what that first regimen that you gave them, how it impacted their overall survival. So I think in my practice, when I have a favorable risk patient, I do that assessment of what's their burden of disease? Do they even need systemic therapy? Can I give them spot treatment? And if I finally get to the point where, yeah, they've got multifocal disease, they can't get any more spot treatment, they're still doing well, they're not symptomatic, and I have to start them on something, quite honestly, what shifted my practice over the last year is updated data from the 214 study that were presented at GU ASCO this past year that actually demonstrated that favorable risk patients over time, there was 8 years of follow-up data from that trial, actually can do really well with nivo-ipi, and which is really counterintuitive, but it kind of not necessarily in line with the original data that were presented, but the hazard ratio over time is now down to 0.82. These patients, you can potentially give them IO-IO and they can derive long-term benefit. So I tend to favor that strategy if I can, you know, get the therapy in. But I think at the end of the day, there's probably a lot of things you can do for the favorable risk patients, and there isn't a wrong answer.
Well, let me tell you what makes it confusing. Hold on. Before you talk, Tom, I just want to get something out while I can, because one of the things that I personally find very confusing is if you take that same case that I just presented of a patient with low volume disease, asymptomatic, non-visceral, if I'm correct, and then you say they presented that way, then they're not favorable anymore, right? So clinically, do you treat those patients differently? The same low risk, you know, low volume, et cetera. But if they present with Mets, they're high risk, they're considered not favorable, right?
That's correct. Like presenting with overt de novo metastatic disease is not a good thing. You know, these people that progress 5 years out, they had metastatic disease at the time of nephrectomy and it lay dormant for 5 years or was microscopic. So I think the biology of the disease is different. I think timing does matter with metachronous versus synchronous disease. Tom, I know you've got some thoughts on this.
Okay. One minute, Tom, just tell me clinically, tell these people what to do. What do you do with these patients?
The IMDC classification was never designed to pick which therapy to give. And it's important we keep coming back to that. The 214 trial, which decision was made to exclude those favorable risk patients, with hindsight was probably a mistake. Although reversing on our mistakes is very unusual in oncology, we tend to embed them. Having said that, Raina and I will agree on intermediate and poor risk 100%, but in that good risk population, single agent VEGF targeted therapy has never been beaten. And so from a survival perspective, and it is true that those patients within that good risk disease have more angiogenic tumors, which are more responsive to VEGF targeted therapy. So it is indeed very fair to still give those patients sunitinib or single-agent pazopanib. Raina is also correct that the most recent eight-year updated data brings ipi-nivo back into the game, and indeed, in the ESMO guidelines, ipi-nivo now appears with a weak, not a strong, but a weak recommendation in good risk disease.
So I want to hear a little bit more about what you think about belzutifan. But first, a few things from our chat room. First of all, Raina, maybe you can take this. This is from Hassan. So he asks a couple things. First of all, is pembrolizumab the best combo with PFS of 23 months being the longest ever? Another question he asked is, in patients who are getting a combination IO-TKI, do you continue both indefinitely?
So two very good questions. And I think I'll echo the initial theme of the IO TKIs are more similar than they are dissimilar. I think it's really hard to these trials enrolled patients at different times. They also enrolled different patient populations. The percentage of patients that had favorable risk disease that were enrolled on the pembrolizumab lenvatinib study was around 33%. So a third of the patients had favorable risk, likely low volume, low burden disease. So I think it's hard to say that this one is better or that one is better. I think they're more similar than they are dissimilar. With the caveat, the situation where I tend to use LenPem is a situation where I've got potentially somebody who's locally advanced on borderline resectable, unresectable, and I'm really trying to get them to try to be resectable. They don't have metastatic disease. I tend to favor that regimen for trying to get them to surgery.
All right, let's talk a little bit about belzutifan. We could spend the whole hour talking about belzutifan, but you know, just a little bit of a tasting menu here. So first of all, Tom, can you just review for us without doing slides, but just your own vision of how the agent actually works? And right now in your own clinical practice outside a clinical trial, how do you utilize this agent?
Yeah, so it's a novel mechanism of action. It's a transcription. It inhibits the transcription factor HIF2-alpha. It was associated with a Nobel Prize won by Bill Kaelin and others. It is very specific and very well tolerated. It is particularly sensitive. Our original work was done, Eric Yonash, in VHL renal tumors. And what they showed is in these VHL-driven tumors, HIF2-alpha inhibition was associated with exquisite sensitivity. In more complex clear cell pretreated renal cancer, when there are multiple pathways at play beyond just VHL and VEGF, it appears to be active, but not as spectacularly active, particularly in later lines of disease. Some people believe if we move the drug earlier, where VHL and VEGF are potentially more important, we may show higher response rates. And indeed, there's some evidence to support that. And for that reason, we have adjuvant trials in combination with pembrolizumab and frontline trials in combination with pembrolizumab and lenvatinib. Because of its specificity, it is well tolerated, with only on-target toxicity of hypoxia, not only, but predominantly on-target toxicity of hypoxia and anemia. My clinical experience is that it is a very active agent in some subgroups of patients. And you can see there's a tail on the curve where it appears it works very well in heavily pretreated patients in about 30%. And it's possible that there is a biomarker out there that we haven't yet discovered. I suspect it will be an angiogenic type biomarker.
So, Raina, I'm curious about your experience with the agent and particularly how you deal with the anemia.
Yeah, very good question. I think I will say because it has on-target toxicity and it's a very potent agent, the toxicity can be very well managed with dose adjustments and dose modifications. It's very predictable and it is dose dependent. In my clinical practice, with regards to the anemia, I do use EPO to help maintain, higher hemoglobin levels if patients are beginning to drip down with regards to their hemoglobin. And that could be a strategy actually to maintain dose intensity, but mitigate the anemia. And in my practice, you know, when I see the hemoglobin kind of dipping below 9, they haven't yet gotten into that grade 3 range, but they're kind of in the dipping down into the 8, mid 8. That's when I tend to employ EPO so I don't have to actually stop and discontinue the therapy and, dose modify. The hypoxia, I think it's very important to actually tease out if patients have underlying, pulmonary conditions, they've got COPD, they've got a high burden of lung metastases or pleural base disease or lymphangitic spread. You know, these kinds of patients were not enrolled on the clinical trial because of eligibility criteria that, limited the amount of comorbidities that individuals had. But I think in later line RCC, we do see patients that have, lung predominant disease that's not well controlled. And I think it's really important to be careful with this agent because of that risk of hypoxia in somebody that has compromised pulmonary function.
So that's really great. And, I think it's a learning curve. Every time we have a new agent, it's certainly going to apply here. Just kind of, we'll maybe pick up a little bit on this later. We're getting a bunch of questions about this as well. But Tom, I mentioned we're about to do a myeloma program there. They're already into quadruple therapy. You were talking about triplets. Oncologists are always trying to add stuff, but it seems like maybe it would be pretty feasible to do the triplet tolerability wise. But what about the hypoxia? Does that make it more complicated? Or the anemia?
We've done one triplet trial before in kidney cancer. We did COSMIC-313 of ipi-nivo-cabo, and we found it was hard to give that triplet. And one of the take-home messages from that triplet was it appeared that the toxicity compromised efficacy. And clearly hypoxia and anemia on top of fatigue and other adverse events associated with lenvatinib may be an inhibiting factor. We've seen some phase 2 data for the doublet, not for the triplet. And the doublet data does look tolerable, but I think that we'll have to wait and see regarding that. Neil, my feel on it is that I'm quite encouraged, as I said previously, about the PFS data of the HIF and VEGF combination. And I would not be surprised if it was positive for PFS without a huge increase in adverse events. I can tell you in the adjuvant setting, where we've been giving it and we've been giving in the clinical trials, the signal for toxicity, you can tell which patients are on therapy, but it's not like sunitinib. It's quite subtle. It is a well-tolerated agent.
Super cool. That's really interesting. So I want to let Raina move on and give her talk. But Raina, do you want to hear my Tom story?
Oh, I would love to hear your Tom story.
Well, actually, the audience might have heard this one before, but I think a couple months ago we were doing a webinar, and we always have these pre-meeting rehearsals where we, like today, we sat and we're talking about what happened at ASCO. So we were doing this, and I look at Tom, and I can see he wasn't in his living room because we worked with him so many times. I know his living room. I go, Tom, where are you? He said, well, I'm in Tokyo in a cab. This is like 15 minutes before we're starting, right? And he's on his phone in Tokyo because he had to go give a talk. I go, well, where are you going to do the webinar from? He goes, well, I don't know. I'm just getting there. So he walks into this huge room. We're like 2 minutes ahead of time. I said, just sit down and put the phone in front of you. Let's see if it'll work. And for the whole hour, it was like perfect. Nobody had any idea. He was sitting there in this huge convention center doing the webinar. So I was telling your colleague, Peter Schmidt, about that this morning. We were recording his talk, and he thought it was pretty amusing. Any thoughts about the experience from your end, Tom? You were saying it was like carpool karaoke.
It was a pretty close run thing, Neil, I have to say. And it was about 4 in the morning in Tokyo as well.
Right. So funny. All right. Anyhow, yeah, people don't know all the craziness that goes on. But anyhow, let's get down back to your talk, Raina. But first, I want to, kind of, again, just take a breath before we get into it, because you're going to show us some data in the adjuvant setting, just to get a take on where we are today in general with adjuvant therapy. Was there anything at ASCO that changed your view of adjuvant therapy? And we saw some, I think, interesting data. I'm curious how, you're going to talk about the survival benefit. But let me go back to Tom and say, generally speaking, and I don't know what kind of regulatory constraints you might have there in the UK, Tom, but at least from a theoretical perspective, how are you thinking through adjuvant therapy? In what situations do you think adjuvant therapy is something that should be brought up as an option to the patient?
So adjuvant pembrolizumab has been approved by the UK reimbursement agencies. survival signals in the adjuvant setting have been hard to come by, but curing patients associated with long-term quality of life is actually very cost-effective. Delaying progression-free survival without a survival signal by a few months is not very cost-effective. So actually, these sorts of drugs get reimbursed quite quickly, but drugs which are only delay progression tend not to. So this is available in the UK and is reimbursed. The pembrolizumab data, from my perspective, is practice changing, and it's important because metastatic clear cell renal cancer is a lifetime of therapy and it's a lethal disease. And the reduction in risk of death is clinically meaningful. But there is a toxicity signal. I say to patients there's about a 10% chance of life-changing toxicity. But overall, I feel it's worthwhile because I think the reduction in the risk of death in this setting is really important.
That's a really interesting perspective, though, in terms of cost, like delaying the cost of treating metastatic. I mean, maybe from the patient point of view, it's different, but interesting. I'm curious, Raina, what your perspective has been seeing a survival benefit. Does that change how you think about it and how you present it to a patient? When you present it to a patient, do you go, if you don't want to do anything, it's totally fine, or do you encourage them to do it?
You know, I think in the adjuvant setting, it's all about risk. It's all about risk benefit and risk of recurrence. And it's also, a lot of it depends on where the patient is at and the things that matter to them and what is their risk tolerance. There are some people that have a very low risk tolerance, and even minimal risk is intolerable. And there are some patients that have a higher risk tolerance, and marginal gains are not really going to move the needle. And so I think it's a very different kind of discussion that we have, because we know in the adjuvant setting, by definition, because it's adjuvant therapy, that we are over-treating some patients. We're likely under-treating some patients, and we're getting it just right in some patients. And we don't really have a lot of great markers to help us tease out how to do it better than just clinical parameters, which I think is why the KIM-1 data that Tom had just presented from EMOTION-010 is so exciting, because it layers in on the clinical parameters that we've been largely using a very time-dependent marker that's literally like, this is the state of the disease right at the time that you want to assess the disease to understand how that marker can inform a selection of treatment. So I think we're excited about the KIM-1 data because of this dilemma that we face in the adjuvant setting.
I mean, I've got to confess, was this presented for the first time, or has this been out there, this KIM-1 thing? It looks really exciting. When did it first come out, and when was it presented?
There's been work on KIM-1 for many years. Actually, a lot of it has been lent by Vincent Wu at the Dana-Farber. He's done an amazing job actually teasing out the prognostic and potential predictive benefit. There's been subset analyses, I think, from 914 and I think one other study that I'm blanking on the name of that Vincent presented in his discussion. Tom, you probably know it, but this is not a new thing.
And what about cell-free DNA? You see that, you know, it's coming in, you know, so many different adjuvant situations, obviously colon, but we're hearing about in many other situations. Tom, cell-free DNA in the adjuvant setting? You've done a lot of work with bladder, but what about here?
I've been around the block a bit with cell-free DNA in kidney cancer. And it's, I make parallels with digging for oil in Saudi Arabia. The depth of your well is important, and you need to go really deep for clear cell renal cancer. It's not a noisy cancer. It's a quiet cancer. And therefore, you need to really be doing whole exome sequencing and going really deep for circulating tumor DNA. And actually, methylation signatures in the end might turn out to be better than the classic ctDNA. But if, you know, Guardant Omni or Natera, the current Signatera assay, in the adjuvant setting, they're not going to be positive in the vast majority of patients. So ctDNA at the moment is not ready for prime time in clear cell renal cancer in the adjuvant setting. Papillary renal cancer is different. I think papillary renal cancer is more noisy. And I think as the tumor burden increases and the disease gets more complicated in the advanced setting, it's easier to become ctDNA positive.
So that's really interesting. And we have so much. I knew this was going to happen with you two, that we run out of time here. But hopefully you can at least get through your talk, Raina. But I have to bring up a case from the chat room because it sounds like you really could. This person needs some help. Daniel has a 56-year-old man, Raina, with metastatic sarcomatous RCC, progressed after ipi/nivo, then cabo, then belzutifan, and then TiVo. Not a candidate for a clinical trial due to poor performance status and mucocutaneous fistula from his abdominal disease. 56 years old.
Oh, that's challenging. That's challenging. I mean, the one regimen, but a regimen that has not been highlighted has been lenvatinib and everolimus, which could be utilized. However, the status of the fistula is going to need to be assessed because any VEGF TKI is going to worsen the fistula. So, you know, with a fistula, if it's a cutaneous fistula and there's outward, you know, if it's a bowel fistula and there's you know, outward release of material, it's a lot better than an internalized fistula where you're pooling materials, you know, inside the body and there's a risk of infection and abscess and so forth. So, but it's a really, you know, challenging situation. But the, you know, I wouldn't re-challenge with any IO therapy. I would not do that. The one TKI that's a good TKI is lenvatinib, but the status of the fistula needs to be assessed.
So let me just do one other thing. I can't resist it when I see these situations because I know they're clinical. This is from Dr. Kumar from a Florida cancer specialist, Tom. He has a patient who developed PRESS syndrome, posterior reversible encephalopathy, on lenvatinib pembro, switched to ipi/nivo, did fine. Question is, can he go back to a TKI in the future in a patient who've had PRESS syndrome? Tom.
I think it's always difficult to re-challenge with a drug, with an agent, because the likelihood is the toxicity will come back. Because it was reversed last time, you know, you might say, you know, we'll give it a go and see what happens. I think overall, Neil, it's about consent and it's about risk and it's about, comes back to what Raina said before, which is it's about what the patient's prepared to tolerate. I mean, the question is how long maybe they had the VEGF TKI for and if they had a spectacular response. If it was amazing and was working and suddenly stopped and they've got lethal renal cancer, then that's something you might say, well, in the end, that's a risk we'd be prepared to take. But I've got to tell you, as soon as you get into these, you know, these neurotype diseases and problems like that, things are really serious. So my temptation would be avoid if at all possible. If you go down that route, the consent process is incredibly important.
You know, it's interesting.
It seems a lot like belzutifan. Oh, I'm sorry, Neil. I was going to say belzutifan could be a consideration in this setting. And somebody
had belzutifan.
The
patient already had it. Yeah. So, no, you know, it's interesting. What I was going to say is that investigators, a lot of times they get like frustrated when they can't come up with a great answer. But actually, that's one of the most common reactions to our work. When you struggle with an answer, people feel reassured because they think, you know, they don't know the answer, but you do. If you don't, it's actually reassuring. So I want to go and move to Raina's talk. But I also want to point out, I was thinking during our discussion about adjuvant and, you know, your eloquent discussion in terms of risk benefit. I don't know if people know there used to be an adjuvant meeting of all cancers, and they would publish a book. You had to send in, you know, your thing, and then they would like print it a few years later. And I have like 20 of these. They had 20 like these for years. Sid Salmon, I don't know if you know who he was, did these adjuvant meetings. They had breast people, GU people, etc. And then they stopped doing them, but we still have the books. Anyhow,
awesome.
Raina, let's talk. Well, you know, speaking of adjuvant therapy, that's where it was, you know, in the past. But obviously, I guess we move forward. All right, let's talk about it, Raina.
Well, it's been really exciting, actually. There's been, you know, decades of studies and decades of trials that have patients have enrolled onto, looking at cytokine-based therapy and TKI and IO therapy, and here we are with KEYNOTE-564. This was the updated data that was actually presented at GU ASCO, in 2024. And this was a trial that enrolled patients with clear cell RCC, having had no prior systemic therapy, having just had a nephrectomy within 12 weeks of randomization. And it enrolled patients who had T2 grade 4 disease, T3, T4, N1, or M1 NED, meaning no evidence of disease. They had resected metastases. And patients were randomized to receive pembrolizumab for 1 year or placebo with a primary endpoint of disease-free survival and a key secondary endpoint of overall survival. We had initially seen the data on the primary endpoint presented several years ago in a plenary session at ASCO, positive for DFS. And actually this year, we saw the overall survival data that were presented. Here is the disease-free survival curve, investigator-assessed disease-free survival. We show a continued benefit over time. The curves separate and stay apart throughout longer-term follow-up with a hazard ratio of 0.72 at the updated interim analysis. And then here is the overall survival curve. This is the first therapy to improve overall survival for patients with kidney cancer. Many, many, many trials have come. Many patients have come before this study. But this is the first regimen to actually demonstrate a clinically meaningful and statistically significant improvement in overall survival. So the 38% reduction in the risk of death with adjuvant pembro, the hazard ratio of 0.62, and you can see that the curves are separating and continue to kind of separate over time. So I do think that this data are practice changing because, you know, here, you know, the hope is that we're not only delaying progression, but hopefully preventing progression and likely curing some individuals with the utilization of this treatment. Here is the safety data at the third interim analysis. I think nothing that is really different than what we would expect with pembrolizumab. I think the key thing to keep in mind here, and Tom alluded to it a little bit earlier, is, you know, the rates of patients who may get significant immune-related toxicity related to the pembrolizumab. So 7.6% of patients required the use of high-dose steroids to treat a significant immune-related AE. There was 9.4% that had grade 3-4 tox. There was no treatment-related deaths that were seen on this trial, but I think it's important to identify that probably around 10% of patients will experience some significant immune-related toxicity with this therapy, and they need to be informed about that. So now we're going to shift. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to maybe just take a break for a second before you finish your talk. And just, you know, I know you're about to get into this, but again, just in terms of clinical update. So Tom, for practical purposes, can you just talk about your clinical approach, you know, outside of trial setting? Again, I'm not sure what kind of regulatory issues might be, but generally speaking, how you think through the issue of therapy of metastatic non-clear cell, particularly first line.
So I think that, again, this is a this is an environment where we haven't collected enough data to give you good answers. I think it's fair to say that VEGF-TKI monotherapy has been a standard of care with small randomized trials and small single-arm cohorts for a significant period of time. And some, but not all people, believe cabozantinib is the best single-agent therapy. There's been no survival advantage associated with these, and it would be unfair to say you definitely know the answer. More recently, the combination of VEGF-TKI-IO, particularly Len-Pen or Cabo-Nevo, has presented, I think, quite good efficacy signals, but again, in relatively small single-arm trials. And under those circumstances, because all the rest of the data is so poor, it'd be reasonable to say that VEGF TKI IO combination probably looks a bit better. Single agent immune therapy, I would probably avoid. And so therefore it's a choice between VEGF TKI or VEGF TKI IO. And I think most people are beginning to go for the latter because of these relatively attractive signals.
You know, it was such a well-crafted statement that you just made, literally, because it was like a guideline statement. Rain, anything you want to add to that?
No, that's perfect. I think I couldn't have said it better.
Just take that minute. That minute is there, golden. Okay, let's finish all out right with some data on that. Let's look at the data.
Non-clear cell RCC, so we're going to level set with some of these smaller studies that have been conducted. The first thing to highlight is that we've kind of gotten in the habit of lumping all of the non-clear cell histologies into one bucket of non-clear cell histologies, but I think it's important to recognize that these are all distinct entities driven by different pathogenesis and probably are biologically different and probably biologically respond different to various treatments. So I think it's important to understand that. There's the most common of the non-clear cell histologies is papillary. And recently, the WHO criteria for labeling, pathologically labeling papillary RCC has gotten away with the type 1 and the type 2. You're not going to see that anymore. They've just categorized papillary as just papillary and gone away with the type 1, type 2 designations. The next most common is chromophobe, and then, you know, collecting duct, mucinous tubular, medullary, those are all pretty rare, not very common entities, but these are all biologically distinct. I want to highlight the SWOG 1500 trial that was led by my colleague and friend, Dr. Monty Powell. This was a really important study looking at the role of cabozantinib versus sunitinib for patients that have papillary RCC defined histologically. And this trial had two additional arms, a savolitinib arm and a crizotinib arm that actually closed. But at the end of the day, the trial looked at evaluating cabo versus sunitinib in this setting. The trial was a positive trial demonstrating a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival over sunitinib. And this was an important study that really established cabozantinib as a standard of care for those patients that have papillary RCC. And building on the heels of this study is the PAPMET2 trial that is testing cabozantinib IO in the frontline setting as well, that is open and accruing patients. So this was an important study, and it was done through the cooperative groups through all the networks across the US enrolling to this, specifically papillary trial. Other studies that I will highlight, there are a series of phase two studies that investigated combination IO-VEGF for patients with non-clear cell RCC. I'll highlight here the B6-1 study that was presented. It enrolled patients that had non-clear cell histology, had received no prior systemic therapy, and had advanced or metastatic disease. This trial actually enrolled 158 patients, so it's a pretty substantial sample size, and patients were given lenvatinib pembrolizumab. It's a single-arm study. It's not a randomized trial with a primary endpoint of objective response. And what we saw was, one, we saw differential response rates across the different subsets, but a respectable response rate of 50.6% in the total cohort of patients that were enrolled. And because the sample size was 158 patients, you can see that for the papillary cohort, it was nearly 100 patients with papillary RCC that had enrolled on this trial and had a response rate that was on the order of around 50%. I think what we do notice is lower response rate in the chromophobe population. This is a little bit different than what we had seen in the next trial that I'm going to show you of nivo-cabo in this setting. So, and this is that trial. This is a phase two study of cabozantinib nivolumab for patients with non-clear cell RCC. And you know, this much smaller study than the prior study that I had delineated. This was only 50 patients that had enrolled on this trial and essentially demonstrated a response rate in the first line setting of 54%. And then in the second line setting here, 36%, you can see the breakdown by histology. So I think in the context of these smaller single arm phase two studies, we are seeing that signal of efficacy in the for patients with non-clear cell disease. But again, the data is not as robust as the randomized phase three trials that we see for clear cell RCC. And so I'm going to kind of whiz over this because I know we're kind of close to time. We've spent a lot of time chatting about belzutifan already. This is the LITESPARK-004 study for those patients that have VHL disease, demonstrating dramatic response rate of belzutifan for patients with these RCC tumors, a primary PD rate of 0%, 100% disease control rate with belzutifan for patients with VHL disease. So I think this data are really important to highlight. And here is the toxicity data. We've spent a great deal of time talking about belzutifan toxicity, so I will skip over that and end with some questions.
So yeah, we will end in general here, I think, thank both of you so much for working with us here today, and thank the audience as well. And encourage you to come back tomorrow night to hear about triple negative breast cancer. But I just got to bring up one other point to conclude. I'm going to throw this to Tom. This is from Peggy in the chat room. I'm not sure who Peggy is, but she sounds like she has a little bit of an interesting background. I think she was reacting to your thought about the adjuvant data and the idea of extending progression-free survival. And she comments, I don't know whether she might have even been on the Keynote 564 study, I don't know, but the idea that when you extend the progression-free survival, the idea is to hang in for the next medication that comes along. And this is something we heard like in myeloma 10 years ago. You know, the myeloma people would go from trial to trial, and their patients would always be getting therapy 2 years before it would get approved, and you just go from trial to trial. And I think what Peggy's trying to say is, yeah, progression-free survival, one of the benefits is you get to wait for the next drug. Now you got belzutifan that wasn't around when that trial started. Any thoughts, Tom?
I think it's such a positive way of looking at life, and I wish we could bottle that.
100% agree. Thanks so much, Peggy. And thanks to you, Raina, and Tom for joining us tonight. We'll be back tomorrow night with Dr. Kalinske and Dr. MacArthur. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Raina.
Thanks,
Tom.
Thank you. Bye, gang.